moving on to item 9, which is our review of portfolio performance for the period ending March 31, 2022, a relatively quiet and sanguine period during our financial history. Just kidding. All right, so item 9. I think this morning we're going to have with us Scott Whalen and Tim Price. So Tim, I'm going to turn this over to you to kick it off. Good morning and congratulations on your 10 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's interesting 10 years. We've doubled our assets. We've more than doubled our team. We've changed consultants, changed banks, changed strategy. So a lot going on, but I'll step back here and say thank you to the board for a decade. I think the average tenure of a CIO is 3 to 5 years. So I'm definitely long in the tooth here, and it's been a great run. So thank you to all the trustees for all of that.
That wasn't a warning that you're getting ready to move.
We'd like to assume you want to continue your good run.
I am exceeding actuarial expectations. I intend to continue to do so. But I'll turn it over to Scott for the first quarter review.
All right. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. Just pulling up the report to share my screen here. Downloading is 75% complete.
Modern technology. You might have to feed the squirrels a little more in that tray, you know, the little food tray that where they turn the wheel to get that thing. I've had intermittent connection issues, and it's typically at around this time in the morning. I think I'm a Comcast customer, and the demand is exceedingly high during this period, as probably most of you know.
Okay.
Been fortunate.
Sharing screen.
There we are. Well, we started it.
Your patience there. So as per usual, I'll start with economic environment. Just make a few comments and respond to any questions that you may have. I'm going to move to slide 6 of tab 1, just as a sort of a launch page for some of my comments. So this is old data, but the themes remain and have strengthened or even probably more relevant today, given what's going on in the markets. And it's really all about inflation and rates and geopolitical uncertainty and earnings, how all that is intertwined and impacts earnings growth projections. Looking at what drove the markets. So thinking back to when Fed Chair Powell was making comments to the Senate Banking Committee back in November 30th, that's really when there was a big sea change. He stopped using the word transitory to describe inflation and even said that word should be retired. And so the market's ears perked up, and things have changed really since then. And inflationary concerns rather than deflationary concerns have come to the fore. If you look at the table on the upper left-hand portion of the page there, you can see headline consumer price inflation year over year. You know, it had started to rise certainly before Chair Powell made those comments, but up to that point, the market and really the Fed was calling it as transitory. We're going to work through these supply chain problems. We're going to get back to normal. The inflationary pressures will abate, and we'll get back to sort of a more normal expected inflation rate. And that hasn't happened, as you can see, all the way up through March. Pretty hot inflation even into April. The number, year over year number there, is 8.3%. People are talking about peak inflation now, but people are also talking about ongoing concerns and inflation becoming more of a systemic problem. In terms of geopolitical uncertainty, obviously the big news there is Russia's invasion of Ukraine just a a horrible humanitarian tragedy. The indicator there is you can look at the Russia's stock index. Back in October, it was at 4150 through March, significant decline. Currently, it's at 2330 something, indicating a 45% decrease in the Russian stock market, and the sanctions going on there having a big impact. And that's important for a couple of reasons. One is the energy that Russia delivers to the world, and two is the agricultural commodities that Russia and Ukraine deliver to the world, feeding into the inflationary pressures. That is reflected in the next table below, where you see the commodity spot index prices, again, going back to October at 525 and through March at 625, currently at 653, indicating overall a 24% rise in commodity prices. And then lastly, on global bonds. So best indicator I have there that's been going on is the changes in the 10-year treasury bond. And going all the way back to August 2020, when it hit a cyclical low, the 10-year treasury was yielding just about 50 basis points, 0.5%. That rose to the beginning of May to close to 3%, so a big increase. And now it's sort of pulled back about 2.75%. So the 10-year treasury is moving around quite a bit, sympathetic to inflation, but not in lockstep, because of course the treasury has lots of different factors influencing it, like global demand and safe harbor or flight to safety asset. And as rates rise, also as rates rise in the US, others see those rising rates as an opportunity to get higher returns. And so they move their money into the US and buy treasury bonds. So kind of a natural counter influence on treasury bonds. So I'm going to talk just a little bit about inflation today before I move into performance. And I want to move to slide 10, where we specifically call out inflation. And you can see there in the chart on the lower left-hand portion of the page, CPI, just historically to give you sort of a picture that provides some color and context about where we've been today versus where we've been historically. You can see in the global financial crisis, you know, we had some little bit of rising CPI, and then of course the global financial crisis kicked in and we were very concerned about deflationary pressures. But the current rise today is really pretty historically significant. And you got to go all the way back to the 1970s to see an inflationary period where we had higher inflation. And then you look at where what the big drivers are. So energy, of course, being a big driver, because you can't make anything without energy, and hydrocarbons are in just about everything. But also it goes beyond that. It goes to food, and that's increasing, partially because ammonium nitrate that comes out of Russia and the Ukraine are used to make fertilizer. And so fertilizer costs are skyrocketing around the world. And if you look at the right, you can just see the monthly price movements increasing and, stable at a high rate. Moving, staying on this page, but moving to the notion of what the Fed is doing to try and stave off continuing high inflation. Of course, they have a couple of tools at their disposal. One is the Fed funds rate that they set targets for and try and manage. And that rate for a long time was held at zero, trying to keep the economy going, trying to keep money easy, trying to keep liquidity in the system. And they just started raising that rate back in March. As I'm sure you're aware, they had a 25 basis point increase in March, another 50 basis point increase in May to take the target rate up to 75 basis points, still below 1%, still below very low historically. And they're talking about five more increases through the remainder of this year, 50 basis points. So the market sets expectations, right? And the market is expecting 50 basis points in June, another 50 basis points in July, and then three more 25 basis point increases through December to get you to a target, if the market is accurate in its expectation, of 2.5% for the Fed funds rate, but you know, very high. And very high relative to the historical past, not hugely high relative to long-term historical averages. And you may recall we had our CIO in talking to the board about inflation expectations and interest rates, with the notion that interest rates haven't, longer-term interest rates haven't really risen in conjunction with inflation unless the Fed is really trying to manage that through higher target Fed funds rate. And our remaining view is that the Fed is, you know, they're going to raise rates, but they're not going to raise rates precipitously the way Volcker did back in the mid-80s to choke off inflation, and that rates have natural pressures to keep them, you know, relatively low relative to history. And so rising rates up in the 5-7% range, we think is probably unrealistic. And, you know, that's playing out today as rates have sort of stabilized and moderated, despite the fact that the Fed is anticipating raising the Fed funds rate through the end of the year. Now, the Fed has a second tool in its toolkit, and that's quantitative easing. And they've said that they that has stopped, and they'll start to let the Fed balance sheet, that's upwards of $8 trillion, start to bleed off really beginning in June. But it's going to be a long, slow process. They expect that they'll get back to a balance sheet that they're comfortable with, about half of where it is today, over the next 5 to 6 years or so. So, and the market knows that and understands that and is pricing that in. A couple of more points. One on the labor market, first on slide 12. So the labor market has been interesting. You see the unemployment numbers here. You got U3 and U6. U6 is just a broader measure of unemployment. They've sort of been moving in lockstep, with U6 just being a little higher. Spike during COVID, naturally, and then a very steep decline coming back from COVID. The unemployment rate getting back to pretty near all-time lows. It's 3.9% or thereabouts now. And so the employment picture is good. The wage picture is not as good, although wages have been trending up. They haven't been keeping up with inflation. But this participation rate is of particular interest, with the idea that through COVID, folks have been retiring and not returning to the labor force. So we've got lower participation, which just means lower people out there working, which could lead to wage inflation, and sort of has an impact over on this chart on the right, as you've got the unemployed very low and job openings high. So you've got this pretty big gap here, which is the widest that we've seen, certainly on this chart, and historically it's relatively high as well. Again, another indicator of wage inflation, which could be problematic in terms of a wage price spiral, which is part of what the Fed is trying to do by raising those rates and slowing the economy down.
Scott, if I could interrupt for just a second.
Please.
I don't want to get too far away from page 11. You had a statement on page 11. We believe the inflation will most likely begin falling later in 2022, which will become welcome news for the Biden administration. But what makes you think that that's the case? to the layperson like myself, it looks as if we're on a real tear here, and it's going to continue to go for quite some time.
So I think the primary reason why we think that's the case is base effect. So energy has risen significantly. You saw that chart showing that the energy component of the commodities index was up 35 or so percentage points. Oil is currently around $110 a barrel, off from very low numbers through the pandemic. And so that base effect coming from very low prices to what is currently today higher prices gives you big inflation numbers. But going forward, it's not like prices are going to come back down, but those huge price increases we saw coming off out of the pandemic are not likely to recur. So it's really a base effect impact, Jerry.
Except for, and I don't present myself as any expert on this, it looks to me as if the higher energy prices are just now beginning to flow through to other commodities and to other end products.
That's fair.
The fact that diesel fuel is costing so much, the fact that people like Walmart and Amazon had such miserable results recently, suggest that we're only now beginning to see the effect of energy prices flowing through to the end user.
No, I think that's fair. And that's why we look out to sort of towards the end of the year when those will have sort of worked their way through the system as well.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Yeah. You know, just our view, and our view is one of many. We're sort of in line with the consensus for what it's worth, but I get your point, particularly if we start to see a wage price spiral, which could be very damaging. Moving to the consumer. So consumer spending has been strong, and consumer balance sheets are very strong in support of consumer spending, largely because of all the fiscal policy largesse that was designed to save us through the global pandemic. A lot of folks were able to strengthen their personal balance sheets. You can see consumer expenditures on both goods and services have risen. You can see over on the right, U.S. household wealth has risen significantly. Fair part of that is due to housing prices and the fortunate who own real property. The concern is that, you know, with inflation, that will quickly erode those consumer balance sheets and bring that ability to spend down. And then sentiment, interestingly, despite the what looks like consumer health on the previous page, consumer sentiment is falling off, an indicator that consumer spending may pull back as well. And the view there is that's largely due to inflation. And then I think this chart on the lower right is really interesting. This is biggest issues for small businesses. And there's a number of them, right? They're concerned about inflation, cost of labor, quality of labor, interest rates, and sales. And you can see how these things have moved over time, particularly back since since COVID. Sales was a huge concern. Quality of labor has been sort of a stubbornly increasing concern. But then you look at inflation, and it just shoots way up. And Jerry, that actually may speak to your point where we're seeing this inflation coming through the system, and we see this big tidal wave that's coming our way, and we're not really sure what to do about it. So ongoing concerns about inflation for small businesses sort of overshadowing some of the other more historical concerns. And with that, I'm going to move just one more slide to equity valuation. So I've been talking a lot about inflation and rates, equities. You know, inflation and rates is all about concerns with duration and how that's going to impact investments. And it's a very clear impact with respect to bonds, because as rates go up, the cash, future cash flows that you're going to get from bonds are worth less. You're just discounting them at a higher rate, or, you know, because your bond is a lower rate, that bond is worth less than bonds at higher rates. But stocks have durations too. And you think about the value of a stock is just the discounted value of its future cash flows. And so any stock that has cash flows further out into the future that's discounted at those higher rates back further, it is going to be hurt more than a stock, say, that has a high current dividend yield, or you're getting more cash up front today and that cash is more stable. But all in all, you can look at the price earnings ratios and see how they've started to come down. This is through April and is just reflective of concerns about rising rates, and then also that earnings growth slowdown that the Fed may be engineering by raising their rates and pulling back on the liquidity they have in the system. So that combined, you're seeing those price earnings ratios, those multiples compress a little bit. Interestingly, they've compressed more in international developed markets and emerging markets than they have in the US. And you can see that sort of by the steepness of the decline here compared to the steepness in international developed, the orange line, and emerging markets. And then you can also see it over here with the blue lines being the valuation metrics or multiples in the US, and then international developed and emerging markets. So US, much more expensive. You're paying much more for a unit of earnings in the US than you are internationally. That's been the case for quite some time, but it's even more so now. And taking that to the chart in the middle, you can see that this is in percentiles, right? So percentiles of expensiveness relative to history. So US relative to international developed is the blue line, and it's about as high as it has ever been relative to history, in the 100th percentile. And then same with emerging markets, very high, you know, down a little bit, but in the 90th percentile relative to history. So US very expensive, you know, paying attention to the divergence between US valuations and international valuations, and moving into more international has been sort of like catching the proverbial falling knife, because that difference has just gotten greater and greater as the US has gotten more expensive relative to international investments. And with that, I will pause and respond to any questions. I will stop sharing for a moment just to see where we are.
So, Scott, if you would just briefly comment on, you know, we've talked about the equity markets. Just a general comment, if you could, on the inflation environment and whether and to what extent, both in the private equity and private credit market, it has in any kind of serious effect on us, or what those effects are.
So you're talking specifically in private equity and private credit?
Yeah, in general. In other words, taking the inflation scenarios and just quickly overlaying them on the
So in private equity, you can think about that in a couple of ways. One is private equity is reflective of public equity. So to the extent that inflation and rising rates and slower earnings are impacting public equity, they will also feed into private equity at sort of a delayed pace. You also have pricing power in equities. So over the long term, equities are a reasonable hedge against inflationary pressures, because companies can raise their prices. Some have more pricing power than others, but to the extent they do, equity should be a hedge against inflation. And then with respect to rising rates in private equity, you've got that discount, that discounting mechanism that I talked about, where higher rates are going to discount future cash flows, and their present value will be worth less. So just like that affects the public markets, that will affect your private equity as well. And then rates, also, there's leverage in private equity company. The funds that you invest in borrow to make their investments, right? You put in the funds to buy the companies, but they also borrow more to buy them. And to the extent that those borrowing rates are going up, there'll be less left for the private equity investors like yourselves. So there will be certainly pressures on private equity, partially offset by the companies in your portfolio's ability to raise their prices and keep their earnings and cash flows high.
And on the private credit side?
On the private credit side, so that's a really interesting one. It's, you know, you can think about it like floating rate debt. They're making loans to companies that have floating rates. So as rates rise, the rates that you're getting from the companies that you've invested in will also rise. So that's an offset and helpful in a rising rate environment. The flip side of that is, you know, if the Fed is trying to engineer an economic slowdown, those companies are going to, their earnings are going to get hurt, and they will have a harder time paying, you know, meeting the obligations of those rising rate bonds or that rising rate debt that you hold. So rising rates is good for you to a certain degree until it starts causing distress with these companies. And they just, you know, if it gets bad enough, they just can't pay their bondholders. And then, of course, it goes into default and you work through the default process to get what you can. So credit in a rising rate environment is, private credit is good until the point that, you know, you kill the goose that lays the golden egg, because you just choke off their ability to pay their bonds.
Yeah, we obviously with the FFP have a significant change that we've engineered over time, right, into private equity and private credit in particular. So it matters. I just want to call it out because it does matter, and we, it doesn't sound like we're in any kind of position to be concerned at this point. But it's worth noting in the overview, I think.
And the beautiful thing about the FFP is that you have 3 years of cash, essentially short-term instruments, to cover you,
right,
on a gross benefits basis, right, and on a net benefits basis, assuming that the county and the plan sponsors don't stop paying in. It's 10 plus years. Okay. Or I think it's actually 9 years, but yeah, so you should be fine.
All right. Well, thank you. I don't see any hands up or other comments. And if not, Jerry.
Go ahead, Jerry. You're on mute.
Jerry, you're on mute.
There, I was trying. Wasn't working. I was about to let John go first. I was wondering if you could expand a little bit on this provocative question on page 78. You don't have to go back to it, but basically, how can the Russian oil gap be filled? I mean, it's mind-boggling for a layperson like myself to look at this and think that as recently as 3 years ago, this country had reached a magic goal of being energy self-sufficient. And now 2 years later, we are begging the Saudis to produce more oil, and they won't return the administration's phone calls, reportedly. And instead, we're going to deal with the Venezuelans and the Iranians to see if they can pump more fuel or more oil.
Yeah.
And a sidelight, I thought it was fascinating to see an article the other day that just quietly got out there that the Diablo Canyon plant in San Luis Obispo County is supposed to be going offline in 2025. And now the Newsom administration is quietly nosing around about seeing whether or not they could extend that end of life cycle. It's just, for the layperson, it's just almost impossible to follow this and see any logic to this whatsoever. And the best part, yesterday, is that President Biden said that the increase in energy costs, especially at fuel levels, really good because it's going to really force us to get into alternative sources of energy. I'm thinking this is crazy. And that's one person's view, but it's mind boggling.
I don't even know where to start with that. No, it's really interesting. And the thing about Iran and Venezuela, it occurs to me, you know, as I think about that, that there are enemies. They're just not enemies that have invaded anybody recently. So we're gonna go talk to them about seeing what they can do. But they can't make up the shortfall that is not coming out of Russia now. Their ability to produce is quite a bit lower than Russia in total, and you know, they can barely make up the so they certainly can't produce as much as Russia produces in total, and they can barely make up what the decline in Russian output has been since they invaded Ukraine. You know, we talk about Germany as being really receptive to Russian energy production, and they are, but obviously based on the increase in global prices, it's not just Germany that's susceptible, it's the entire world. And interestingly, you know, with fracking, there are no plans by fracking companies to increase their production beyond the fields where they're already producing. So they're not talking about more exploration and opening up new fields. They're talking about, you know, giving cash back to shareholders through repurchases and dividends rather than reinvesting in new production. So it doesn't look like the energy problem is going to be solved domestically.
And excuse me, John, if I could just sure. Adding insult to injury, the strategic oil reserve, which was a nice little PR stunt, has, near as I can tell, the price of gas has gone up about 50 cents a gallon since this wonderful release of the strategic oil supply, which will have to be replaced by purchasing oil at a higher level than a higher cost than what we did before. It's just, I don't know how these guys keep a straight face and explain all this stuff and say it all makes sense. John, sorry.
I'm with Jerry. It doesn't make much sense. My question is, Scott, I think it was yesterday's journal, talked about Russia defaulting on all of its bonds in no small part because we won't allow them to continue using the banking system, which they're required to use to repay the bonds. Is there any impact on us directly or indirectly that you're aware of here?
I'm going to turn it over to Tim to see if he has any color on that. I'm not aware. I haven't looked through your portfolio securities holdings, but I'm not aware of any Russian bonds that you hold.
We don't. We haven't had a global bond allocation in quite some time. And within our domestic bond allocations, the liquidity, you know, these are, call it 95%+ US, and the other 5% would be Canada and UK. So it's really domestically biased right now.
Good.
Good answer. Any other thoughts or comments before we move on? I'm not seeing any currently. So Scott, continue.
Okay. I'm going to reshare my screen and move to performance.
I don't know what level of detail, Scott, you plan on going. And I look at the first quarter and kind of using the sports analogy from a really bad game, you kind of burn the tape because you don't learn a lot from it. But so I'm assuming you're just going to hit the highlights of what was a pretty
worst quarter. Absolutely true. So starting with the highlights on slide 2, you can see exactly what you would expect. In the last 3 months and year to date, you started at 11.5 billion. You had net cash flow of 100 million. And then the down market took $393 of losses, getting you back down to still over 11 billion, but certainly below where you started and down market. Moving to the total fund. So underperformance relative to the policy index, which is always disappointing, still protected you on the downside relative to peers with more traditional portfolios, but not as much protection as you may have expected. So your policy index did quite well at just negative 2%. The total fund, negative 3.4. And then moving to the attribution, you can see it was really in selection effect. So the your managers underperformed, and that's the takeaway. So no, you know, we like to see big protection. And in the past, you guys have shot the lights out in periods like this. You still did better than your peers, but not as well as your policy due to manager selection, right? They were positioned one way going into this, and when the regime changed, they weren't as well protecting on the downside. So they were getting more on the upside than the downside, and underperformed going into this current market. Total fund here, you can see the risks still. This is over net of fee performance over 3 and 5 years. You can see your lower risk profile. That's where that downside protection came from. And then the performance relative to peers still, you know, sort of coming off of that big, strong up market where just your standard 60-40 portfolio pretty much beat everything. And just going to take you to one manager that there will be a recommendation on. Looking at,
there it is.
Jack, thank you. Jackson Square. So, you know, this just becomes a story of kind of the classic things that we look for prior to a termination recommendation that I know your staff is bringing to you. You know, it's not just all about underperformance, but that underperformance has caused some concerns in terms of losing assets. So Jackson Square losing assets, as well as underperforming in periods when you would expect them to outperform. So it's really that being able to explain the periods of underperformance in line with their strategy. So having lost some confidence in Jackson Square, making a termination recommendation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will pause, see if there are any questions before wrapping up.
All right. Are there any, Jay? Yes, you had your hand up.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Scott. And Scott, kind of a general question, and this is where I think it's supremely helpful to have a consultant's perspective, someone who can survey, you know, the more than just say one plan's point of view. But it's a question about the diversifying portfolio. And we'll talk about it later when staff does a review, but the goals of the diversifying portfolio are pretty ambitious, right? Low correlation, but positive real returns. And that's something I think just about any plan is kind of on the lookout for, right? A hedging tool that still makes money. I'm curious, you know, I think it's been a little bit, it's been kind of difficult to find appropriate strategies for this allocation. I'm curious what other plans are doing in terms of finding solutions in this kind of allocation.
So it's across the board. So first off, other plans, most of which are, you know, more traditional plans than you, but not following a functionally focused portfolio investment strategy. By and large, are still using the traditional diversifiers. So sort of a core fixed income, many of them in core plus, kind of adding some additional risk in the portfolio in terms of credit and emerging market debt to get that additional return. some adding, or many adding real estate and hedge funds as diversifiers with correlations that are lower to equity risk. And so it's really kind of across the board, but most still just sticking with sort of core traditional fixed income strategies to provide that diversification.
And I think that's the thing I appreciate about the uniqueness of FFP is the lack of a kind of a traditional core bond or IG bonds portfolio and corresponding lack of duration in the plan. That said, you know, the yield on core is back up to almost a reasonable level and kind of, you know, you're sure we're in a hiking environment, but you know, the portfolio turns over time, right? And so maybe we benefit from that environment also. Can mm-hmm. you speak to kind of, you know, the pluses and minuses, say, of having a more peer-like duration profile?
Yeah, so that's interesting, particularly in light of the rising rate environment. You know, I haven't talked to Tim about this. And so, you know, I'm a little bit reluctant to start just spitballing with the board before talking to your investment staff, but what the hell. I would think about as rates continue to rise, instead of a more traditional core bond portfolio and a credit portfolio in your diversifying portfolio, I would think about maybe pure duration risk in government bonds, treasuries, and maybe some duration plus inflation protection in TIPS. You know, as you're getting more from that portion of the markets, from that from those types of securities.
Great, thanks for that. And it's a very, very difficult thing to find a strategy that kind of fits into that diversifying portfolio. And so I'm happy to hear kind of the ideas, looking for things that are appropriate there.
Thank you.
All right. Any other thoughts or comments for Scott? I don't see any other hands up, so carry on.
So that concludes my report.
Well, all righty then. All right. Thank you, Scott. Tim, I see you are back on.
Should we allow Scott to answer the text that Tim just sent him?
I need to check my text.
It's going to take him longer than that to respond. No, I mean, we don't disagree that in a rising rate environment, you know, things get repriced and you have a new opportunity set. So I'd say we're still in that process. So I don't disagree with Scott or Jay on this. But it's just a matter of TIPS have always been interesting, but, you know, they'd be based off of zero. You know, floor rate, and you know, in that kind of environment, you're just not getting paid. But as you start to get paid for some of these securities, the opportunity set has expanded dramatically. We'll leave it at that, based upon the market pullback and the rise in yields. So I'd say, you know, while we have greatly struggled to find appropriate strategies in the past for diversifying, the opportunity set is expanded and is continuing to expand. But let me go ahead and share my screen here.
Are we now transitioning to item 10?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Yeah.
No. I just want to be sure that we were concluded on item 9, because I think we're prepared to move to item 10. Am I right?
9B.
9B. I'm sorry. Yes.
Mr. Chair, could I add one other non-flip observation?
Sure.
This is where I always get concerned, and it comes with both sides of this issue, about not being in a position to move, to make moves with any speed. We can't move like an average retail investor, I understand that. But as these markets tend to show some fundamental changes, it occurs to me that sometimes we're left with making a decision to move or make a significant change after the ship has already sailed. So we talk about these not alternate investments, but other strategies that are being made available. What kind of timeline, Tim, do you think we might have in looking at making any of these changes again before the ship has sailed?
Well, I guess two comments on that. One is we want to be cautious about making any changes in a rapidly moving environment. So the proverbial catching the falling knife. We want to make sure that we understand what's going on in the market before we move into it. The second part is I would say that we've had three and a half strategies that have been in the research pipeline for a period of time. And we've, been cautious about moving forward on them, and the opportunity set around those strategies, I think, has become a lot more interesting. And those are things like some of the trend following strategies. And for whatever reason, I'm blanking on what else we're looking at there. But I think, these are things that we try to keep a number of things in the research pipeline and say, let's make sure we understand them. And when we're ready to move on them, there's a body of knowledge there, and we can move faster than, it used to be that we would identify an opportunity, the board would authorize an RFP, the consultant would issue the RFP, and by the time the board made a final decision, we're talking 9 months. I think we've brought that down closer to 3 months, but we still don't move with a lightning speed, nor do we want to move with that kind of lightning speed. I think we want to stay true to the asset allocation. We want to stay true to rebalancing. But I think, we've tried to build a fairly robust pipeline, particularly around the private markets and the diversifying assets that allow us to move when appropriate and in a faster way.
And if I could maybe just add on to that, I think about this in terms of tactical versus strategic, and tactical opportunities. You have the opportunity, you as a board have the opportunity to take advantage of that through rebalancing. And then also if, the very infrequent times when big opportunities present themselves, when they happen typically after big drawdowns, when there's blood on the street and everybody's panicking and valuations are ridiculously cheap, and maybe you just want to move into risk, you have a mechanism to take advantage of that through your investment staff and special call board meetings, et cetera. And then, so that's tactical, which, you just don't do very often because those fat pitches don't come along very often. But from a strategic perspective, I think a battleship is better than a speedboat. You have long-term liabilities. You have a structure in place that where you design a strategic asset allocation that is expected to keep those promises to your participants over the long term. And those adjustments happen very slowly. So for example, in a rising rate environment, if you may want to move to treasuries in your diversifying portfolio at some point, you just keep an eye on rates and you evaluate what those higher rates will do, what the impact will be on the strategic asset allocation over the long term. And those opportunities, they're just not snap your finger, take advantage of opportunities. So those are my two cents on that.
Yeah, I'm happy to see us take a, I guess I'm looking for something that I think I'm hearing from Tim, and that our life cycle, if you will, is moving down. And I'm not making a case for lightning-like decisions. I don't think we're in a position to do that, nor do we have an obligation to do that. We have more of a responsibility to make informed decisions. But I just want to make sure we're not doing analysis to paralysis, so that when something finally looks like we want to make a move, we miss the boat. So I'm happy, I guess, with where we are, and because I certainly don't think we're in a position to make lightning decisions.
I would agree. Okay. On that point, let me go ahead and share my screen and we can talk about the first quarter from, and this is the goofy part where you all see something different than I see. So are you seeing my memo?
Yes.
Okay. Good. As long as you can see it, I'll be scanning back and forth here. But this is the CIO report, the quarterly report that accompanies the various report, and we talk about kind of progress towards functional goals, and we've already kind of alluded to some of those functional goals here. So just a reminder, this is the kind of report card that says, are we meeting those functional goals, and was the complexity that we engaged in the portfolio worth it? Because we mentioned this relative to the simplest possible implementation, passive index. So let's move to page 3. And this is the report card for each one of the sub-portfolios and then everything wrapped up all together. So as we've noted many points in the past, liquidity program working as expected, maintaining the high quality, short duration, the number of months of benefit payments is right on target there. This is the easiest part of the portfolio to monitor because it is measured in terms of matching to our liabilities and making sure those benefit payments are there in reserve and working as expected, and it is. Turning to the growth portfolio, I would say the comment here is, I think the growth portfolio is working on an absolute return perspective and on a risk-adjusted perspective. I think the critique here is because we've taken less risk in the portfolio, there's been a lag relative to the global equity index. You're seeing about a 1% underperformance to the global equity markets over the past 5 years. That's below expectations, but we are getting close to an 11% rate of return over those 5 years. So it is the long-term return generation part of the portfolio. And we're doing it on an efficient basis. So the Sharpe ratio is 0.9 relative to the global markets of 0.6. So we're getting efficient implementation of risk. We're just not taking as much risk as those global markets. Risk diversifying, as alluded to earlier, is where we tend to focus quarter in, quarter out. We've made two changes over the past year, the funding of the SIT LL CAR strategy and the termination of the parametric volatility risk premium strategy. So there have been two recent changes. On this page, we are measuring relative to a 5-year period. So, those recent changes will take time to filter in there. But the correlation has been higher than we would like to see. I think part of that is, particularly in the first quarter, we saw pretty much all markets move in, I would say, close to lockstep. So equity markets traded off. Anything with duration traded off. I think if you go back to, think back to the Verus report for the quarter, I think, the benchmarks were like down 2.9% for growth, 2.1%, 2.5. I mean, everything was just kind of unidirectional in the first quarter there. The trailing returns on a positive, on a real return basis, so net of inflation, are negative 2.8. I think this is an area that's been frustrating because we've started to improve and then inflation took off and ran over the past year. So some of that improvement on a nominal basis is masked when we look at this on a real basis, but that is the nature of what we're trying to do here, is get this up above inflation, and that's been a laggard. This is very liquid, and we can redeploy it for rebalancing purposes. I think this goes back to Jerry's comment earlier about taking action there. The market pullback has been significant to date. I don't think we're in the there are bargains to be taken advantage of, and we're ready to move on all fronts point in the market. I think this has been largely a repricing of risk kind of in the face of rising interest rates and rising inflation. And now we're kind of at an inflection point to say, are earnings impacted now? And I think, in the past couple of weeks, we've started to see those earnings impact and get another leg down here. So to my point about not trying to catch a falling knife, we want to see how this all plays out. When we see kind of stabilization, we're going to move on the rebalancing front there, and you probably will see us move some of the risk diversifying assets into risk assets as we get some clarity on that. Let's move to page 4, a little bit deeper dive on liquidity. Again, everything really working as expected here. You'll note that the Insight strategy had 124% growth over the past year. I think they've brought in additional assets, kind of recognizing the fact that this cash flow driven investing style has started to be a little bit more popular, and you know, they are one of the leaders in that, bring actuarial modeling into the portfolio construction process. SIT and DFA pretty much call it flat-ish on asset and on product and firm growth. And then, you know, I think duration all within normal bounds, yields all within normal bounds, and the one-year return, while negative based upon a rising rate environment, recall that we do tend to have a buy and maintain portfolio, so we haven't locked in those negative returns. It's a mark to market at this point. Turning to slides 5 and 6 on the growth sub portfolio. Obviously, you see a lot more yellow here, and a number of products have had significant losses. Some of this is just the market performance, and some of this is, you know, actual client outflows. You know, most notably, and we'll, I'm not going to belabor the point on Jackson Square since we have a later agenda topic on that one. They've underperformed and lost assets. You know, a lot of the other ones are tend to be market performance plus a little bit of rebalancing more than client losses. But the general theme here is we are seeing cash flows away from risk-oriented managers. So folks who are focused on, you know, small cap and growth and emerging markets, those have been areas that have been out of favor, and we've seen net cash outflows from those spaces. And on 6, you know, the one-year returns are kind of all over the place at this point, but we've already touched on that. I would just note that, you know, over the trailing 10-year period, when that global equity index did 10%, you know, we are seeing more strategies than not outperforming that global equity index. I think when we're seeing some underperformances largely in the non-US space, and that's a reflection of the fact that, as Scott noted in his presentation, the US market has been expensive relative to global markets, to non-US and emerging markets, and has gotten more so. So, you know, reversion to mean typically works, but sometimes it takes longer than you'd like to see. So I think our exposure to the non-US developed space and emerging market space, while prudent on a going in basis, hasn't borne fruit to date. But those valuations we would expect to, you know, to revert to mean. We do see, you know, more potential triggers for that, but we live in a very uncertain market environment right now with that, the battle between rising rates and potential for global recessions in select markets around the world. So this is a rather delicate state right now, but you know, this is what we've seen over the past decade. Let's go to 9. Oh, and just one other thing to note on here is you do see the Invesco REIT line item. We didn't fund the Invesco REIT allocation during the first quarter. So this is a custom strategy. You're not going to see a lot of the data show up for until we get some live performance numbers in there. But that's something that was funded during the first quarter. Page 9 is the diversifying program here. And I think, you know, just one or two items to note on this. The AFL-CIO, you know, this is a intermediate term bond fund focused on construction loans with government guarantees. We tend to think of this as something that would benefit during a flight to safety. Certainly, we haven't had a flight to safety. We've had, you know, anything with rates getting pushed down, you know, in the same direction as the equity market. So here you see that trailing 1 year correlation to growth, as opposed to the 5 year we saw earlier. And I think this is where we've really seen something that was a little bit out of line with what you might normally expect, but just the fact that, you know, rising rates and expectations of rising rates have impacted both, you know, duration in fixed income and duration in the equity markets at the same time has pushed the correlation up there. The 3-year correlation is still 0. We think over time, you know, the relationship is sound. You can certainly get short periods of time where you see some abnormal relationships on that front. Let me go to 10. We'll talk about total fund on 10 and 11. So Just a reminder, we try to capture more of the upside, less of the downside. So as long as you see the blue line above the red line, we're capturing more of the upside and less of the downside. So that that spread had drawn in quite a bit and expanded back out. And now we're seeing, you know, kind of, you know, I think the maintenance of that spread, which is what we want to see. And this is over a trailing 3-year period. And then finally on slide 11, just a couple of comments here. So during the quarter, you know, the Cicero Total Fund did outperform the Simple Target Index. And really, what we've seen over time is the risk-adjusted returns of the Cicero fund outperforming the Simple Target Index over 1, 3, 5 year period, 1, 3, 5 and 10 year periods on a risk adjusted basis. We did lag the Simple Target Index over the 3 and 5 year basis on a nominal return basis. But I think that efficiency has been kind of been the hallmark that we've had in the portfolio for at least the past 5 or 6 years. And we're seeing that efficiency come through there. So let me pause there and see if there's any questions.